This is videotape number L1, defending the information web, new ways of thinking about security.
A lot of you probably know me as Fat Mudge. I mean, Simple Nomad, so I don't know, half the people probably didn't get that. He's real thin, I'm not. Okay, anyway. I'm up here to introduce my my good friend Richard here. He's been a frequent speaker at many of the DEF CONs and Black Hat conferences here. He's a great guy. He tries to push the envelope, something that a lot of the hacking community really admires. A lot of times his talks, he gets up and he is extremely challenging. And I really, really encourage you to get in there and try to pick apart what he has to say, because it's often very inspiring. And and be sure and check out his website, themeworks.com. It's in the literature and everything else. Look at his writings. Whenever you get an opportunity to see him or read him, I encourage you to do so. Anyway, so without further ado, let's go ahead and bring up my good buddy, Richard Thieme.
Thank you very much. It is always great to come home to Black Hat and DEF CON, where, as I never tire of saying, those of us who love it know we love it because we don't have to explain anything to each other. And we share a world of presuppositions that we cannot find easily shared in other places out there. What I want to talk about today, got about half an hour, and I want to present a challenging model of reality in relationship to security, because things change so fast that we can still operate according to the old models of reality as if they are still present in our world, when in fact they are not. The machine, said Marshall McLuhan, easily masters the grim and the dumb. And therefore, he said, the masters of technology must be intelligent and lighthearted. I think this characterizes our gathering today. I hope we can lighten up as we talk about some serious stuff. I want to take you out to the edges of our thinking. And if you are for a moment afraid you're going to fall over the edge, at that point, my goal is to give you a push. I want to give you some things to think about, some points of reference that define the new space in which we are coming to live and work. You know, people talk about, tritely, the thinking outside the box. You know what it means to come up against the walls of the box of your thinking, push through, stumble through the darkness, go through a zone of annihilation, which challenges everything you think or believe is true about the world. And find yourself not outside the box, but just in a slightly little bit bigger box. So we never get outside the box. The boxes are concentric boxes like Russian dolls or Chinese boxes inside one another. And that's why, as E.B. White said, it's no wonder how complicated things get, what with one thing leading to another. So things have gotten very complex. I want to reinvoke McLuhan by saying, context is content. When he said the medium is the message, what he meant, I believe, is that we have to learn again and again that the context in which we live totally frames, determines, and structures the content we think it contains. And every time the context changes or shifts, we learn new content as a result and have to absorb it anew. If you don't shift with the context and recognize the new context, then you start applying the same principles over and over again, even when they no longer apply. The context shifts rapidly. When I was a child growing up, I do remember my mother saying, "Shh, everybody be quiet, I'm on long distance." You know, nobody says that anymore. But they do still sometimes say, "Don't interrupt me, I'm on the internet." And you do know we are moving rapidly toward a world of ubiquity with wired and wireless networks in us, threaded through us, and in of all of our environments, clothing, and situations. so that people will no longer see the internet as a thing. It will disappear into the background the way the power grid would probably be the most striking thing to someone from the 19th century showing up here today. They would see power lines everywhere and we never noticed them. Or the way computer networks have completely restructured the future and time. A short, simple example. Les Shipman was hired by Mohawk Carpeting to design neural nets for them, which would enable them to be more productive. They were doing 30-day planning at Mohawk Carpeting every 30 days, which only seemed appropriate. What the neural nets enabled them to do is begin planning productivity and allocating resources not on the basis of actual orders coming in, but on the basis of patterns it and only it could perceive in the orders coming in, from which it then extrapolated a likely future. They discovered that if they did not reallocate those resources more and more frequently, after 30 days elapsed, they would be so divergent from the true orders coming in that their productivity would have gone down again, and therefore they now do 30-day planning at Mohawk Carpeting every 24 hours. In other words, it is literally true that 30 days now takes only 24 hours, that is 30 days of duration, and some medical devices, because of the time it takes to develop them, are obsolete just about the time a prototype is finally developed. So, in the old way of thinking, to use war in space as one of the dominant metaphors of this presentation, this is the way someone spoke of it just a few years ago. Warfare, high above the earth, he said, could litter space with speeding debris that might rip into commercial satellites and space shuttles. This is U.S. military's space chief speaking, Ralph Eberhardt, an Air Force general. He said that instant intelligence and communications were so important to the U.S. that future enemies might consider blowing up each other's satellites. It was a pretty radical notion. I'm concerned, he said, about debris in space and not knowing what's going to happen once you blow a satellite up, because even a speeding fleck of paint can ruin your day if you're on the space shuttle. That is the old way of thinking. He is thinking of vehicles having metal skins which can be penetrated by debris. This is a new way. Quote, force fields and plasma shields come closer to reality. Spaceborne protective energy systems, like deflector shields on the fictional starship USS Voyager, are on the drawing board of real-world scientists. You know that by the time an article like that is written, they are long past being on the drawing boards and are being tested or have been tested for several years in Nevada. Cold plasmas are ambient temperature, ionized gases capable of shielding satellites and other spacecraft, making them invisible to radar. Do you remember when we were first getting UFO reports? No, you don't. But when we first got UFO reports in the late 40s and the 50s, people said they couldn't be real because they didn't show up on radar. Somebody could see it, but it wasn't on radar, and therefore it couldn't be real. The other thing they said made it not real was that it didn't feel like when you encountered such a vehicle, as people reported it, you could touch the metal skin you were touching. The closer your hand got to it, what felt more and more like a force field or a slippery field around it, because there was some kind of energy field preventing debris and you from touching it. Now, as I say, when this article finally appears, a friend of mine in 1993, because he is as obsessive as any hacker is, he writes for Aviation Weekly, and he would position himself outside the Air Force base in Nevada with night vision scopes and video cameras and stand there all night in order to see what was flying in. And what he saw was what he called the dripper, because it was a completely ionized aircraft so that the skin glowed with molten plasma and seemed to drip pieces of plasma through the night vision into the night sky as it zoomed like an arrow, he said, over Area 51 and on into the unknown and non-existing bases beyond it. In other words, an energy field to repel objects, prevent us from touching them, and absorbing all electromagnetic spectra so that it is frankly invisible, only a couple of years ago was considered impossible and was then announced as a radical breakthrough long after it had itself been tested. Therefore, we live in different islands of time and have to communicate across models of reality. which are radically different from one another. People inhabit different worlds, and someone has to see the big picture in order to determine who is talking to who, in order to animate what I call the field of subjectivity. And I really want to stretch you on this. The field of subjectivity is the big picture, or the model of reality in which all of these different pieces are connected. And it is more than official reality as determined by media through which so much of our images of reality come. The big picture these days is a model of reality that must be protected, and warfare itself is intimately involved with protecting or attacking the model of reality that others have. Reality is constructed out of images, thoughts, and linked and mined bits of meaning. Reality is designed. Reality is created. And when there's an absence of truth and people think they feel a vacuum sucking their projections into it, we set up a black market in truth in which we exchange bits and pieces of data in order to build an alternative model of reality. What you heard from Jim Munford this morning was someone who refused to accept the official reality created and sustained by what we'll call the MOD, the Masters of Deception, and insisted on creating an alternative structure of reality, which we would say in the black market of truth was truer to what we really think is real. So how we frame reality is a function of the flow of energy and information in a system. All structures are a function of energy and information. The form of energy is itself information, and information generates structures, whether you're talking about a computer program, a network consisting of thousands of nodes, a DNA molecule, or a whole universe. The code, the form of the information itself, creates a context, and that's what I mean by the field of subjectivity that animates, informs, and directs the human project. I want to talk about information and information technologies and space wars because they have become metaphors of the whole entire air, space, ground, battle space, and show us the emergent context in which we live, but which we do not see. The information web is the web of all information radiated by a structure. It's not just communication technologies. It's behaviors, it's structures, it's everything about that structure that you can discern or pick up, either looking at it directly or by looking elsewhere and seeing it reflected. You can infer all of the information web, the entire shape of that structure, from just some of it. Behavior and structures in themselves are information, and that's why anything that moves talks. That's why those who aren't controlling their egos when they're hacking are visible, because it is only the ego that moves. If you are totally stealthy and your ego is still, no one can see you. And therefore, information security is not about systems of information security merely. That's too small a picture, too much of a tree. Whatever moves in the whole web or system gives information about the geometry of the space it creates, about its angles, its momentum, and its trajectory, and it's about people piecing together behavior, intention, and motivation from connecting those disparate bits of data into an alternative model of reality. In England, during World War II, it was easy to create simulated environments because you had a limited physical space, a smaller space. Today, it means strategies of deception, strategies in inner space, or the inner life of humanity in the aggregate, and above all, the management of perception. The management of perception is the bottom line or benchmark which determines the nature of warfare in inner space, and I will explain why I think that's true. War in space and information warfare converge as single metaphors of this new way of being or thinking which we inhabit but don't even see. It has changed. It has crept up on us. Somebody asked Ernest Hemingway, how do you go bankrupt? He said two ways, gradually, then suddenly. This is how all change takes place. Drip, 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 drip. You reach a tipping point. The organizational structure hierarchically rearranges itself. So does a psyche. So does a civilization. I'm trying to make the point that computer security is a subset of security in the global battle space, which is increasingly defined from a point of reference beyond air and ground and out to the cislunar Earth-Moon subsystem of space itself. Security in such a system comes from predictability and stability, and therefore those who convince others that they have a secure place, who create the illusion of predictability and stability when there is really no there there, those who create the illusion of fixity in a world in flux, those who build the digital cages in which we real birds fly, those are the real masters of deception. According to those who teach deception in the intelligence space, I am told, the primary means are illusion, misdirection, and above all, ridicule. Illusion, misdirection, and ridicule. The way a neural net weights certain values to create a model of reality, certain perceptions are weighted and altered and distorted because people want to believe creations or designs or fictions which are aligned with what they already believe. This is going to take place not only at the level of conception, which is the domain of media, propaganda, public relations, competitive intelligence, and statecraft intelligence, but also at the level of perception itself. We are going to hack the systems that determine for people what it is they in fact believe they see, hear, or feel, and they will not know they're in a simulated environment. So, we truly are moving into a Blade Runner world in which the question asked by Deckard of the replicant he had just tested to discover that Rachel was a creation and not a natural born human, how can it not know what it is? I would suggest that we are already in that space and do not know what it is, i.e. what we are, because it is our nature not to know unless we build this big picture model of reality as an alternative. It is happening not only in the domain of information technology, but also in biotechnology. It is transforming our identity itself. Recent techniques, the RAND Institute recently said, such as functional brain imaging, revolutionize our endeavors to understand human and animal intelligence. By 2015, we will make significant inroads in improving understanding of phenomena such as false memories, listen to this, false memories, attention, recognition, and information processing, with implications for designing and interfacing artificial systems such as autonomous robots and information systems. Neuromorphic engineering has produced novel control algorithms, vision chips, head-eye systems, and biomimetic autonomous robots, which when threaded through us, like the artificial cartilage and skin and organs we are already beginning to create, will make of us appropriate subjects for the creation of memory, attention, recognition, and information. In other words, through biotechnology, the very field of subjectivity, which is what we think it means to be human, is going to be designed and transformed. I'll give you an obvious example. I don't want to ask how many of you take Prozac or Zoloft or Paxil. How many of you know someone who takes Prozac, Zoloft, or Paxil? Okay, plenty of you. Understand that if you want to alter the subjective space you inhabit, what you do is take a chemical from the external world and ingest it or inject it or absorb it in order to alter your field of subjectivity, your emotional field. During the last Olympics, EPO and human growth hormone were very big deals because they could test athletes for their presence and still think it was a quote-unquote artificial substance. By the next Olympics, it will probably be generated from within by genetic engineering, or at least by the one after that, and therefore the distinction between natural and artificial will have completely vanished. Once we genetically engineer ourselves to create a depression or its lack, anxiety or its absence, instead of using pills from outside, then when you ask the question, how can it not know what it is, it will be because, as you see, it is our nature not to know what we are. So today we've got fanny pack body monitors transmitting our statistics to the internet. We've got sprinters wearing accelerometers that analyze their kinesthetics and their physiology during a 400 meter dash. We've got watches with radio links to our shoes that track our distance. What we are working on are retinal implants to provide better night vision, a heads-up display with infrared animating it, or a 200-to-1 zoom. You can't arrest somebody for using a video camera with a 200-to-1 zoom when it's their own eye. We have not made changes in the monitoring of vital signs since 1863, when a brilliant guy named Carl Wunderlich invented a chart that hung on the edge of the bed so doctors and nurses could see the temperature, pulse, and respiration. Now we are looking at how to design jewelry or piercings which monitor our vital signs and transmit them wirelessly to us or the net at all times, so that if we have a heart attack, it can dial 911 at the same time it is telling us that 911 is coming. My son went into a friend's factory, if you want to call it that, in Silicon Valley, as I was just recalling at lunch, and his friend showed him a huge space filled with little troughs, in each of which was a headless frog, designed and grown from an embryo, animated and sustained by nutrients. Only the brain stem was there to keep the automatic functions going. The rest of the frog was missing. The rest of the head and brain was missing. He asked my son if he knew what they were doing, and he said, "No, what are you doing?" He said, "We're practicing." This was a prototype for organ farms in which, if we chose to do it, we could walk into a space this size and imagine from here to the rear wall troughs of headless humans grown for their livers, their pancreases, their lungs. I don't know anybody who would not take one on their deathbed from the back of a pig or from a headless human. How can it not know what it is? Information technology is just one aspect of information. Biotechnology, genetic engineering, new materials, and the entire wetware, dryware interface, which we will create ourselves and design progeny for new environments, those constitute the rest of it. So that's why I want to reiterate that context determines content. These things come slowly, but they transform what it means fundamentally to be a human being, and therefore they are transforming us in ways we don't see. You know, a good example of how that works is Eddie Bernays, the father of spin, father of public relations, once worked for a publisher in New York in the 1920s. They wanted him to sell more books. But he didn't just advertise for people to buy more books. He went to the leading intellectual lights of the day, the Nobel Prize winners, professors, all the bright guys and gals, and asked them if human civilization needed literacy in order to function and survive. They all agreed that it did. He asked if they would sign on affidavits that said that. They did. He then called a meeting of architects, contractors, builders, and asked them if they wanted to participate in saving civilization. They did. So what do you think they did in order to do that? Every house, every apartment that you walked into from those builders after the late 1920s contained built-in bookshelves. And in response to the built-in bookshelves, people, without thinking, without seeing them, bought books and put them on the shelves. The bookshelves are context. The books are content. And without seeing that we are doing it, we fill in the psychic space of the context with our own lives. You've got to keep focused on the big picture. Secrets is a good example. Computer security becomes too often an end in itself because it's easier to provide than the hard stuff. You know what is required for real security in the space of business or human life today. It is not just computer security. Use secrets as an example, and the topography of secrecy, which has been developed by the intelligence community. It is easier to identify and label discrete bits of information as secrets than change the behavior of all the people in those systems that manipulate those secrets. Macro security presumes that boundaries around domains, work groups, organizations, nations, whatever, are fixed, but they are not. They are changing as we reinvent new structures. Boundaries around smaller units become increasingly arbitrary, illusory, and difficult to defend because as you ramp up into a higher scale, the permutations and combinations rapidly multiply into multiple structures that exceed our ability to calculate. In other words, secrets are created by topographies of secrets in the first place. They determine what it is we consider a secret because we only consider secrets that we need to defend and protect, those things which fit topographies of secrets and the models of reality we've designed to protect them. In fact, a secret is not defined by anything intrinsic to any bit of information itself, but by the relationship of the information to something external to itself, to a wider context. And therefore, you can infer the existence of secrets or significant facts from other facts which are themselves not secrets. In other words, in another domain, they are not secrets and are not protected, and therefore intelligence, whether competitive or espionage, often relies on human beings coupled to their machinery to discern facts and link and mine them in ways that let them see patterns or the bigger picture. The meaning of a secret, in other words, is contextual. A secret is defined by the context that makes it both valuable and a secret. And in other contexts, they're not secrets at all. Their cocktail party chatter at conferences like this, their business regulations, their patents, their spy satellites, their photos available for purchase, their stories in the local press, their rumors, their want ads, they're all the ways information leaks from the whole space into the domain where they can be seized, linked, and mined for the purpose of determining what a person or an organization is thinking. So an intelligence agent does not look for secrets unless they first share the whole context with the person from whom they are taking the secrets. In other words, on a societal level, the mind is the corporate knowledge of a society, and we give that away. So when we look at war in space, we see that war in space is becoming indistinguishable from information warfare, and that information warfare is becoming indistinguishable from what we call peacetime. The model of reality of space war has changed as we have moved further and further out. This is a paper written a few years ago about spacelift, a supporting pillar for space superiority. The U.S. spacelift system in 2025 will be routine. Though developed primarily as a practical, affordable alternative for orbital access, the multi-purpose trans-atmospheric vehicle will be expanded into a force-enhancing mission, intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance. Humans will move from being more in the cockpit to being more in the loop. In other words, they'll function in the network. The medium for Air Force operations will move from air and space towards space and air. Influence will increasingly be exerted by information more than bombs. Military education will move from being rigid to responsive. In short, information will cease to be that which enhances the larger space. Information will be the weapon itself. And so a successful information attack will require a stealthy and powerful capability that can attack strategic, operational, and tactical information systems. This is what is being developed and is being used. Holographic image protection, cloaking devices, multispectral camouflage, and above all, the creation of synthetic environments that an adversary thinks are real. Now, if you think of what those things mean in space war and in information war, and then apply them back into the space in which we live, you'll see what I'm getting at. Holographic image projections, cloaking devices, multispectral camouflage, and above all, the creation of synthetic environments that adversaries think are real. These are manifest physically in space, in things like satellite bodyguards, airborne high-power microwave systems, and attack microbots. But in the inner space of this cognitive space we inhabit, it is information alone. The way we imagine war in space and information systems is described in the same language because outer space has become simply a metaphor for inner space. Information systems not only link the modules of space war, they are not only critical to it, they determine its very structure, and we live inside those structures. So what we see in space is a subset of information technologies, because the information technologies are the very means by which we see in the first place. Let me give you an obvious example. I mean, it's just so simple, we don't even see it. What I'm seeing right now when I take these off, I have been socialized or trained by all of you to call a blur. But what my body thinks it sees is reality, because my eyes see this field that they see. If I hadn't been told it was a blur, I would think this is what's real. Then I take technology, add it to the organic system, and I'm socialized to call what I see now reality and what I saw before a blur. In other words, the technologically enhanced environment into which I have been delivered, I have been taught from birth to consider the real environment, the simulation, the real environment, instead of the natural environment which my body would deliver unenhanced. Space, the cislunar space out there in which our weapons platforms are increasingly being directed, is unimaginable, separate from the information technologies that make it visible. Therefore, the ideal war is coming to be the one that no one knows has been waged, because it is waged by journalists. In fact, it's invisible to journalists and historians. Not because the actions are camouflaged, but because they look like something else when they occur. In other words, the war in which we are currently engaged. As Bamford said, you have to learn every language in the world. Why? Because we live in a world in which we define the enemy as everybody and the battle space as everywhere, and our need, therefore, is to control, dominate, and manage it. The only way we can do that when the enemy is the mind that I have defined as the mind or cognitive space of the opponent is through the management of perception. It is not merely media, not merely propaganda, not merely competitive or state intelligence. It is coming to be life itself. The entire web of information spun across all aspects of the network or system to be defended, including stealthy attributes, that's what we have to defend in space. Let me give you just one little example of how completely we don't see it because we have been socialized not to see it. A friend of mine wrote a wonderful book called The Missing Times, Media Complicity in the UFO Cover-Up. Now, in the process of doing that, he investigated a single incident at Minuteman missile sites in 1975 in Montana. It was covered by all of the local press. It was not covered by any national press. He learned of it when a friend called him and said, "Can you believe what's going on out here?" Over 3-4 days, he said, "What's going on?" He had not heard a single thing about it. He investigated how that incident had been so successfully managed that it never showed up in the national media. But as it leaked out, as it will, into the black market in which people want to find alternative models of reality, it finally did show up in a national media periodical. It showed up in the National Enquirer. Now, that was 2 or 3 years later. He investigated the National Enquirer and was astonished to discover that it was founded by someone who listed the CIA in his resume in the early 1950s as his place of employment, and that it would have been consistent with the modus operandi of the CIA to create a periodical the sole purpose of which was to discredit true stories when they finally surfaced by placing them where no one would ever reference them or consider them true again. Society itself is both the target and the weapon. Society itself is both the target and the weapon, and the weakest link are the people. So this is a statement I'll conclude with about space. Space is the ultimate high ground, but it is more than a place. It is a set of opportunities, a new dimension of warfare, a final frontier. It confers advantage on all those who transit it regularly. From space, we can observe everything. In other words, space will recontextualize inner space in which we live, all information structures, and therefore simply to secure by locking them down either discrete secrets or the systems which hold or transmit those secrets without securing the entire society or battle space in which we live all the time is therefore futile. Space equals space. We no longer need to declare wars because the war in which, as Bamford said, we are engaged is always going on. We call it peacetime. We are always at war, but it leaves us with only one question. Against whom? Thank you. This was a 3-hour talk, and you enabled me to do it in 30 minutes, and I appreciate you listening.